Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes, and we welcome back today one of our earliest guests on this podcast, Professor Julian Zelizer, who's a professor of history and public affairs at the Wilson School at Princeton University and a CNN contributor. Good to have you back.
Thanks for having me.
Well, you know, I visited the Princeton campus, I think it was last year. I've lost track of time. And one of the first names I heard was Julian Zelizer is one of the most popular professors on campus, that you have one of the biggest classes there. So you have a pretty good reputation. So
That's great to hear. That's terrific. I really enjoy teaching, and that's the core of everything I do. So it's nice to hear that's the response on campus.
Well, we talked last time about your book, Fault Lines, which goes back and looks at the 1970s, which seems, oddly enough, more relevant all the time here in terms of impeachment. We're back to impeachment. We're back to obstruction of justice. But let's just start with some of the more recent news post-Mueller, where the president has made it clear that he is going to stonewall Congress, that he's saying we are fighting all of the subpoenas, not just some of the subpoenas, all of the subpoenas. And you have a piece up on the CNN website saying that that is a constitutional crisis. Why?
Well, it's moving us in that direction if we're not already there. The House Democrats are trying to undertake a step in between impeachment proceedings and nothing, and that is oversight and trying to hold hearings and conduct investigations into multiple issues that have now emerged, most importantly from the Mueller report. But the president is going even beyond, I think, executive privilege, saying, I just won't participate. No one can participate. No documents are coming on any of this, without real justification other than he doesn't like the investigations and he says they're partisan. So everyone's wondering what happens next, and it's not clear what the mechanisms are. That's when you're in that sort of a constitutional crisis.
Yeah, I mean, there's two different aspects of this. Obviously, is the question of executive privilege. You know, presidents do have the right to keep some information away from Congress and from the courts, and this has been litigated in the past. But you raise the question, what can Congress do about it? I think this is fascinating. You know, Congress can issue all the subpoenas. It can find people in contempt. But does that actually make a difference? Congress doesn't run a prison anymore, does it? I mean, they can't do much about it.
No, that's absolutely right. And even if they start to issue contempt of Congress, this will get tied up for a long time. Nothing will be resolved very quickly. So what he is exposing in some ways are some of the limitations that a Congress faces if the president just says no. So there are avenues where Congress can pursue the people and information that it wants, but it won't happen anytime soon. And that handcuffs the legislative branch.
Well, let's go back into the 1970s. In 1974, we did have, probably the most dramatic fight over executive privilege. President Nixon had pushed back efforts by judges, prosecutors, the House Judiciary Committee. And rather famously, in July of 1974, the Supreme Court had issued what a lot of us thought was kind of the definitive ruling on executive privilege.
No, absolutely. And this we keep coming back to comparisons with Nixon, and they're hard to escape. And so this was really quintessential, a key part of the whole investigation. The audio tapes of what happened in the White House, which had been revealed during the Senate committee hearings that were held in 1973, were material that everyone investigating wanted to hear. And Nixon had tried to hold this off. He released edited transcripts of the tapes, but that wasn't enough. And he is stonewalling. And ultimately, it goes to the Supreme Court. And the court says that executive privilege is legitimate. They say it is a right that can be evoked, even if it's not in the Constitution. But other things can trump it. And an investigation where the public had the right to know the truth was more important. And so the tapes were released, and that's where the smoking gun emerged, and Nixon resigned soon after. So I think that's a battle that, we might see a version of it again.
And Bill Clinton, of course, was the next president to really go to court on this back in 1998. When basically the federal judge ruled that his aides could be required to testify by the independent counsel at the time involving the Monica Lewinsky incident.
That's exactly right. Presidents after Nixon had been pretty reluctant to use this power very much, but in the middle of the investigation and Clinton's crisis, he tries to prevent testimony and material, and it doesn't go well for him. The court doesn't rule in his favor. It doesn't go all the way to the Supreme Court because the Clintons don't want to appeal it. They want this story to move on. So that's another moment where the courts actually pushed back on what the president can do.
What I'm a little unclear about is his argument about executive privilege, which he seemed to have waived during aspects of this Mueller investigation. And now he's tweeting out, or on Thursday he was tweeting out attacks on his former counsel, Don McGahn. This is what he said. As has been incorrectly reported by the fake news media, I never told then White House counsel Don McGahn to fire Robert Mueller, even though I had the legal right to do so. If I wanted to fire Mueller, I didn't need McGahn to do it. I could have done it myself. There are some legal observers who are saying that, you know, to the extent that he had any argument about executive privilege, he's undermining it further by lying about it. Does this change the dynamic at all?
Well, yes. So he hasn't used executive privilege yet. So far, it's just been right. I don't want to do it argument. And Kellyanne Conway said executive privilege is still on the table. But many experts, as you said, are arguing it won't work. Part of it is his own tweeting right now about what was said and not said. Part of it is he allowed a lot of these people to already talk to the investigation under Mueller. So it doesn't really work to now say that has to be all hidden. So many people, including George Conway, are saying he's already waived that right and this won't stand up either. Again, we don't know, but I think it's not a clear-cut case that this will work in his favor.
The Democrats are still trying to figure out what to do about the Mueller report and the rather overwhelming evidence, I think, that the sitting president of the United States engaged in obstruction of justice. And of course, there's a lot of political anxiety among Democrats who think that if we do this, it could backfire. The polls suggest that the public does not want impeachment. This would rally the conservative base. Staying in the 1970s for a moment, it is worth reminding people that Republican support for Richard Nixon was pretty solid right up until the end, though, wasn't it? I mean, when Democrats back in the early 70s began their impeachment proceedings, it was certainly not clear the public opinion would support them on that.
Absolutely. We look back and I think people think everything was inevitable and there were clear-cut decisions that Democrats could make. But most polls showed that a majority of the public until the summer of 74 didn't support removing the president. Many, many Republicans proactively supported Nixon and were not in favor of the investigation. And there was no sense at the time, even as this unfolded through the summer, that it was going to end the way that it did. So it was a huge political risk for Democrats to move forward with this. And that's a case where, in the end, the Congress made the right decision and history has rewarded them for it. Just as important, so did the electorate. Democrats did well in the 1974 midterms. In 1976, they retained their majorities in Congress, won back the White House. So it's important to remember that some of the conventional wisdom about how this inevitably plays out or what kind of calculations to make are not as clear as people think.
You know, I think it's almost become conventional wisdom that Republicans hurt themselves by moving ahead with the Clinton impeachment. I know that you're a little skeptical of that, particularly when, you know, they launched this effort. They lost, what, about a half dozen seats, six seats in the 1998 midterms, which kind of shook them a little bit. But then you look at the year 2000 when, Al Gore was running at a time of peace and prosperity, but he was linked to Bill Clinton. And how did the Clinton impeachment play out politically in 2000, do you think?
Yeah, look, it hurts the Republicans in 98. They do suffer some losses in the midterms. I don't think it was just from the impeachment. A lot of this had to do with the way Gingrich had polarized some of the electorate in the years before. But Republicans retain control of the House and Senate. It isn't a wave election. They retain control. And then in 2000, it definitely hurts the Democrats in that Al Gore doesn't really stand side by side with Clinton. He wants to distance himself. The scandal is still looming over the way people think about the presidency. And it hurt Gore's ability to make a much stronger case, I'd say, than that had he been with Clinton and run on that record. And again, the outcome is you have a Republican president, George W. Bush. He'll go on to serve two terms. So even with the Clinton investigation and impeachment, which was not popular, which did stimulate opposition to Republicans, it wasn't catastrophic for the Republicans. So these are really uncertain in terms of how they play out. I'm not sure that should be the basis of judgment for Democrats right now.
You've had a chance to read through the Mueller report, yep. which I found to be much stronger than I was expecting. And obviously, the greatest legal short-term threat to the president is in the area of obstruction of justice. I mean, there may be other legal challenges out there with these 14 other investigations that continue to pend what's going on in the Southern District of New York. But it is quite a catalog of efforts by the president to obstruct this investigation, to derail this investigation, to lie about this investigation. You know, you mentioned before the key case on executive privilege was that Supreme Court decision in 1974, which forced them to reveal the quote unquote smoking gun. The smoking gun was the president sitting there talking about how to obstruct an investigation. So how does what we know about Donald Trump's efforts to obstruct this investigation compare to the charges that were levied against Nixon and against Clinton?
Easily as bad, if not much worse. And if we take Nixon as really the landmark moment, the smoking gun itself is one statement that you hear on the tape where the president's trying to get the CIA to stop the FBI in its investigation. He's giving that instruction. Other stories emerged about, you know, efforts to pay people off and intimidate them. But the clarity of the report in terms of these many instances where it's not subtle what the president is trying to do, to me, is much more grandiose than even what we saw in Watergate. And with Bill Clinton, the same. I think the severity of what has already been uncovered is just much more deliberate. It's much more consistent. It has to complement what we've seen on his Twitter feed, which I actually take as a serious bully pulpit, where he did the same kind of thing over the last couple of years. So there is a lot of evidence of obstruction. And if that's a serious problem for people, it's hard to see all of this and say, well, Congress doesn't really have to move forward at this point.
Yeah. And of course, the other question is, what was it that he was trying to obstruct? William Barr argues, the attorney general, that he couldn't really have obstructed justice because there was no underlying crime. And yet the president went to great extent to derail this. What was he obstructing?
Well, that's what's interesting. To me, the first part of the report is a difficult read as well. And there is no conspiracy proven true, or collusion, as the president likes to say. But it does look, there's an investigation into what were the relationships between Trump campaign officials and people connected either directly or indirectly to a Russian government trying to intervene in the election. And the first part of the report shows with a great deal of evidence there were lots of contacts, and there was an active effort to search for information that they knew was dirty information. And that's ultimately the investigation that the president was trying to stop. So it's a serious substantive issue at the heart of the entire investigation, which many people say makes it much different than the Clinton impeachment, because this is just much more severe in terms of what the concerns are. And they're proven out in the report.
I agree with all of that, but there is another political reality. Mm-hmm. And I was thinking about this morning. You know, after 2016, a lot of folks who do what we do, you know, provide opinions and punditry about politics, had to ask ourselves, okay, what is it we missed? Had we become disconnected with what voters in the heartland were really concerned about, what they were really thinking? And here we are, you know, talking about, and I certainly am, because I agree with you on the severity of all of this, talking about this Mueller report, this Russia investigation, when every political report that I am seeing, when the reporters go out into the field, the voting public does not seem to be as engaged in all of this. This is not something that rises to the top of the list. And so you're hearing from a lot of Democratic operatives and activists and elected officials that this is not what they want to run on. And of course, if they do launch impeachment, that's what the 2020 election becomes about, that in fact the voters do not want this. So this is a difficult calculation, isn't it? A difficult choice for the leaders in the House, because even though the constitutional responsibility may be evident, there's a very strong argument against, you know, going politically on impeachment.
No, I think that's true, and I think it's a mistake to underestimate the pressures that Speaker Pelosi is facing right now, because her objective is to, you know, ultimately defeat President Trump and have a Democratic president replace him, and it's also clear that the Senate at this point will not go along with impeachment. The Republicans are not going to vote that way, at least now. So there's the principal argument: what does a party do when faced with a serious political a crisis such as the one I think they face? And that's why the conversation changed at all, that there is a responsibility I think legislators still feel, even in this day and age, when confronted with something like this. And then the second is politics. Do they look and say, this is going to be either a backlash or it's going to take attention away from the issues that are more relevant to our electorate, healthcare, the economy, and others? Or is there another argument that ultimately checking President Trump is what's on the voters' mind, and some restoration of the health of our democracy, even if they're not talking about Russia and the investigation, that's what's on their mind. And so the question is, does moving forward and forcing everyone to be accountable and showing that Democrats do care about this, does it actually play into that part of the electorate's mind? And I don't have an answer, but I do think there is a way to think about this where it could be a politically important thing for Democrats to show they were elected in 2018. Part of it was an anti-Trump message, and part of this is the restoration of the health of American democracy.
And we can't underestimate the potential political power of these televised hearings. I mean, I think back on Watergate, going back to the 1970s again, and I think probably the most dramatic, some of the most dramatic political theater of our lifetimes took place during those hearings. You know, watching John Dean testify, having the country have to confront the reality of all of this. So that even though I think there is this sort of fatalism that nothing moves the needle, I've argued several times this week, argued that, you know, even if 4 or 5 percentage points off the electorate is going to be decisive. And I don't think people should underestimate, the fact that for a lot of Americans, including Fox News viewers, if there are these televised hearings, this is the first time they're going to be hearing some of this information. Don't assume that Americans are reading The New York Times and The Washington Post or hanging on every word that we happen to say on cable television. But, having these ongoing hearings, as long as they don't become circuses, can be an educational enterprise for Congress.
And that's why there's been a cost to not having this play out in Congress until this point, that a lot of it's really taking place behind closed doors. So back in the 73-74 period, it was the Senate hearings under Sam Ervin in 73. Mm-hmm. And then the House Judiciary Committee, once the House voted to move forward with impeachment proceedings, they had their own deliberations and hearings. And all of that helped to change public opinion. It helped to change how the Republicans thought about the issue. So it was a much more dynamic set of months than we remember, where the process itself was pretty instrumental to helping people think about what had happened beyond very abstract terms. So I'm less cynical that That couldn't happen again. Some people say it'll never happen in this day and age. But I think the weight of what we're talking about, hearing it from the players, hearing it from people like Don McGann, that could be very different than, you know, maybe glancing at a PDF or hearing a quote reading a quote in a newspaper.
Well, I'm going to throw out an analogy that Democrats really will hate, those that happen to be listening to this podcast. But you think back on the Benghazi hearings and what happened to Hillary Clinton. There was that moment in the Benghazi hearing that I certainly remember rather vividly, where I think it was Wisconsin Congressman Ron Johnson is asking Secretary Clinton various things about what happened, at Benghazi. And she kind of had a moment where she says, well, who cares? What does it matter whether there were guys out for a walk? You know, at this point, what difference does it make? And I remember at the time thinking, you know what, that's going to stick with her. And I think that if you look back on, you know, what happened in 2016, the toxification of Hillary Clinton didn't begin with the Benghazi hearings, but it clearly was one of the factors that led so many voters to say, no matter how loathsome they found Donald Trump, he was preferable to Hillary Clinton. So as much as people may dislike what Republicans did during the Benghazi hearings, I think that in given how close that election turned out to be, you know, those televised hearings and moments like that may, in fact, have been decisive.
I think that's probably true. Kevin McCarthy, yes, talked about that openly in terms of what they were trying to do with the hearings. Look, you add all this up, for me, it comes back to what's the substance of the charges. And I think why you've seen public opinion, or at least not public opinion, but you have seen a lot of political thought leaders change their mind within a few days. It's been interesting to watch, including Republicans. Part of it is the substance. And it might be Democrats ultimately have to decide on that and not game out where this is all going, because as we're saying, it's not crystal clear. And there are moments parties have to act based on their obligation or responsibility. And I think that should be in Speaker Pelosi's mind right now.
And I think that maybe one of the sweet spots for the Democrats will be looking ahead. You've seen the president go out of his way to minimize the reality of the Russian attack, which would suggest that he's not going to be terribly engaged in protecting the country against future attacks. And you have Jared Kushner, who is, you know, dismissing it as somehow just a few Facebook ads. So if, in fact, they are able to frame it as one part of this process, as what are we going to do, and are Republicans going to vote against attempts to protect the integrity of the ballot box? That puts Republicans in a very difficult, place. They may feel comfortable right now carrying water for Donald Trump, bizarrely, I think. But it's more difficult to imagine them voting against things that would, in fact, harden America's electoral target.
No, absolutely. And that's the power of a congressional vote, I always say, is that it really puts you down on record one way or another on these kinds of issues, whether it's policy or whether it's, political, constitutional issues like this. And it's one thing to talk about it or not to talk about it, but it will be another if they have to vote on it. And that moment when the House Judiciary Committee started to vote on Nixon, televised, was very powerful. And you had Republicans like William Cohen of Maine who said, I'm voting in favor of the articles. And that was a defining moment in his career. And I think if this is how it unfolds, we might see some of that again. But even if they don't, even if every Republican votes against it, that will be on the record. And Democrats can decide where they want to come down on it. And maybe that would still be helpful in the end to a bigger political argument they want to make about why Democrats over Republicans.
Okay, let's talk about 2020 for a moment. Yesterday, Joe Biden finally, at least breaking story of the year, announced that he's running for president. So what is your take? How does Biden impact this election? He starts off as the front runner, but historically we've had lots of front runners that don't last. I mean, I'm old enough to remember when Ed Muskie was the front runner, and we remember how 1972 worked out.
Yeah, and we can remember when Biden was considered in other runs to be a formidable candidate, and that didn't work out so well.
Not to mention Jeb Bush.
Right. So I don't think anything is inevitable. He has a number of big obstacles. One is he is at odds with a lot of key Democratic policies at this point. So he'll have to make a case that his record is something that's evolving and that he hears where a lot of the party has moved. He's going to have a big fundraising challenge because he's not a small donation guy like the other candidates. And at the same time, he's never been a big fundraiser. So he's going to have to find a way to make that money. And he's going to have to show from today, from the moment he announces right through, Super Tuesday, each poll, he has to show he is the decisive leader, because his main argument is that I can win. And if that's your argument, rather than ideas or rather than grassroots energy, you can't let those numbers slip. And he faces some pretty formidable opponents, including Bernie Sanders, who is above him right now. So he's going to have to get out of their shadow, too.
You know, this is a really interesting point. I mean, oh, it's a cliche to say that he enters the race with a target on his back, but when you make electability the centerpiece, that creates a massive incentive, first of all, on the part of the Republicans to pound away at you, erode that. I mean, I think most Republicans would much rather run against Bernie Sanders than run against Biden, and all they need to do is take a few points off of him. And, of course, you have, what, the 86 other Democrats, all of whom have varying degrees of incentives to chip away at him. So who does he hurt the most by getting in? If we're looking at the various lanes, which is probably helpful in this primary, whose oxygen does he suck off right now?
Well, certainly right away, Buttigieg, Mayor Buttigieg, Cory Booker, Senator Booker, at some level, Beto O'Rourke, all three of them have now a big source of competition for that kind of winning middle of the road lane. Same with Amy Klobuchar.
Center left, non-socialist crazy.
Whatever you want to characterize it as, yes. And Amy Klobuchar as well, who's been struggling anyway, but this will make it much harder. The one candidate who has been struggling, who I think has the potential to be a coalition builder, not everyone agrees, is Senator Warren, someone who can get the Biden and the Sanders voters. But this will hurt her too, because right now, for the next few months, he will be a big story. And it's going to be hard for a lot of the candidates to get that kind of attention. And so he takes, a lot of air out of the room. And so, Democrats better be pretty secure that this is worth it at this point. But again, he's been vulnerable. When he's run before, he has not performed well. And there's a million lanes, so to speak, where you could imagine him tripping up in the next few months. So we'll see how it unfolds.
Yeah. Did you have a chance to see his video?
I did. I thought it was very good. I thought it was a very powerful way to frame his campaign, as the best bet to defeat Trump, but using Charlottesville as a key moment for many Americans in terms of what is this president about and what is the values struggle that 220 is about. I thought that was a smart way to go. Again, a video doesn't do everything, but it was a good opening.
Well, this was really one of the first times when I felt that he was appealing to the center-right voters, the Republican voters, who might be disillusioned with Donald Trump but are afraid of the Bernie Sanders. It did feel that could have been delivered by – that speech could have been delivered by a Mitt Romney or a Ben Sasse or somebody else. But he's getting a little bit of – there's an interesting critique out there that unlike most of the other candidates, he is targeting Trump as very much an aberration of the political system. There are others in the Democratic world who think that this is a mistake, that he should be trying to link Donald Trump to all of the rest of the Republican Party as opposed to going after him as an aberration. And that does seem to be an interesting distinction.
Well, it's certainly a big intellectual argument. I mean, there are many who say that if you just focus on President Trump, you don't really understand how he ended up as the Republican nominee or where the party has shifted in recent years. And if you're not dealing with that, you don't deal with some of the problems we're facing, nor do you necessarily have a candidate who is going to be able to fight in this new political world. And so that's an intellectual critique, but I think it's going to matter on the campaign trail ultimately, and how you frame this debate is framing it too broadly and too optimistically, and not really getting at the heart of Trumpism. Is that going to be enough for a candidate in 2020? And I don't think everyone's going to agree with that approach if it defines what he does in the coming months.
Okay, I want to bring up an issue. I want to bring it up reluctantly, and let me explain why. In my distant youth, I had been watching a local race that I thought was going to be won by one candidate who I thought was by far the most substantive candidate, the best organized, the best known. And I thought that he was going to win, and he lost very, very badly. And I was asking a friend, I said, what happened to so-and-so? And he said, did you watch television? Did you watch him on television? And I thought, what do you mean? He says, look at the way he looked. And this was one of those moments where, you know, again, this is not rocket science to say that voters will often make their judgments based on cosmetic issues. So this is why I'm backing into this to explain why I'm going to ask this slightly embarrassing question, to me. Joe Biden is, like some of the other candidates, I mean, he is a white male. He is elderly. And I'm sorry, the guy's had a lot of work on his face. I mean, I liked the video, but I couldn't get past, like, what the hell's going on with his face?
Well,
I'm sorry to throw this at you, but, you know,
that's fine.
We tend to focus on these ideas and these other things. And I wonder how many other people are going, man, that's a lot of Botox or something.
Well, I don't know the impressions people will have, but I do think the way people look and sound matters. And we might not like it, and it's fair to say that's a bad way to pick a president, but it does matter. And you have a president who is particularly attuned to those sorts of things, and he will, you know, blast out Twitters about these parts to try to characterize who a person is. And I think, you know, in bad ways, this is probably going to matter for all the candidates in different ways. Some people said Buttigieg, they liked him a lot, very smart, but boy, he looked like he was extraordinarily young each time they see him, that he's a teenager almost, and that might matter. And so I don't think the party should discount these sorts of things, and they'll have to assume it's going to be part of the mix. It's been part of the mix since the 1950s when politics went on TV, and we're still living in that era.
Okay, on a somewhat more substantive level, okay, before we move on, you know, absolutely right, this whole Adam Schiff thing, you know, the pencil-necked, you know, Adam Schiff, et cetera. You know, one of the best parts of not being in seventh grade anymore is that you get past that sort of, you know, stupid bully, you know, name-calling thing. And it's like this weird flashback where the President of the United States has taken us all back to the worst aspects of seventh grade. This is our reality, you know. But the other thing that's happening in the Democratic Party is, of course, there's almost this wokeness primary or litmus test where the white males are sort of going through this process of apologizing for their identity. What is your sense about the prospects of this party going through this kind of ferment, you know, having the two front runners being 70-year-old white guys, and how does the identity politics play into that?
It matters, and it goes beyond just kind of questions on which identity are okay or not okay. You know, there has been a phenomenal mobilization of suburban educated female voters, and they were the heart and soul of that 2018 midterm, and they were important to the Clinton campaign, which didn't win the Electoral College but did incredibly well with the popular vote. And I do think there will be something to be said for, with many talented candidates out there already, why is the party so quickly gravitating toward the older white men? It's almost playing into stereotype in terms of the comfort zone of the party. And why not offer a candidate who's from a different generation, from a different experience, to speak to where a lot of the Democratic Party is coming from? And I think this is going to be an important debate. I don't think it will just be on, you know, who's right and who's wrong, which person is okay and not okay. but it will be about why not diversify the party right up top. It's been so long since that's happened. The most exciting moment for Democrats remains 2008 when Barack Obama won election, and it meant a lot about where the party was and where the country was going. And there's a way to think that that could be the same today. That in some ways might be the most powerful antidote to everything that President Trump has been fighting for since he took office.
Yeah, I'm sure a lot of Democrats would love for the 2020 election to be 2008 all over again. I'm starting to worry it's going to be 1972 all over again.
I don't disagree. And I do think Democrats should not underestimate the power of partisanship, meaning the power to get Republican voters into the ballot box and vote for the GOP. And they shouldn't underestimate the kind of enthusiasm slash hysteria that the president is going to whip up with his supporters. He will have a powerful base behind him in the next months as the election gets underway. So whether you think Biden is the inevitable winner or whether you think the Democrats should go bold and that's the way to win, what no one should be doing in the party is thinking this is going to be an easy campaign. This is an incumbent with a good economy and who practices a style of vicious campaign politics I have not seen in a long time. And that can be pretty powerful stuff.
Okay, one more question. I mean, you know, in 2008, we tested the thesis that, you know, can America elect an African American? And of course, in 2016, would America ever elect a female? One of the biggest unanswered questions, obviously, is whether America is ready to elect a gay white male. And you know, Pete Buttigieg, I think, is genuinely the interesting candidate, at least for the moment. You know, even leaving aside his sexuality, but you know, I want to read you what Franklin Graham said. Franklin Graham, who has been a reliable defender and rationalizer of Donald Trump, put out a tweet saying, Mayor Buttigieg says he's a gay Christian. As a Christian, I believe the Bible, which defines homosexuality as sin, something to be repentant of, not something to be flaunted, praised, or politicized. The Bible says marriage is between a man and a woman, not two men, not two women. So he goes on to say, the core of the Christian faith is believing and following Jesus Christ, who God sent to be the Savior of the world, to save us from sin, to save us from hell, to save us from eternal damnation. Now, this suggests that the Christian right that has no problem with a president who pays off porn stars, etc., is going to make a big issue of the fact that, number one, that Pete Buttigieg is gay, and then number two, that he claims to be a gay Christian. How does that play out?
Yeah, I mean, the polls do show that most Americans don't have any problem right now with having a gay president, which for me is over a majority came out at least in one significant poll. And that does, you know, it's based in the changes we've seen in American culture and society within about a 15-year period. Mm-hmm. I don't think a lot of Americans are where he is. And I think a lot of Americans outside the religious right have really lost any sense that they are consistent and not hypocritical in what they think. So if these are the kinds of arguments made, you know, I don't think that's going to help the Republican cause right now.
Yeah, I tend to agree with you. Julian Zelizer, thank you so much for joining me. And the book is Fault Lines, which, as I mentioned before, is becoming more relevant really with every passing day. So I appreciate you joining us again on the Bulwark Podcast.
Thanks so much for having me.
And thank you for listening to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We will be back on Monday, and we will do this all over again.